So we'll,
is that his wife that was with him?
Yes.
Background. This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 27th, 1997. I'm at Goodnight Hall, and I have Ray Gleckler, Bill McCormick, and Jack Jarrett?
Yes.
Jack Jarrett with me today, and they were members of the 150-pound football squad from 1947 and 1948. Those are the 2 years? And we're going to be talking about that team today and about their participation in it. Let's start off talking about how each of you got involved in the football, in the team, on the team.
Well, I think that Danny Mansfield, who is the coach, posted a notice somewhere. There was a notice put into the campus newspaper. Was that right?
Interact. We don't
I
have to go in at
we're
time.
All on,
yeah,
we're all
you're all being mic'd. Yeah.
I first saw the notice on a bulletin board on the lower campus. I remember that very distinctly, and I'm sure they had them posted around.
Yeah.
Ray may have seen it in the newspaper, but I saw it on a sign on the lower campus about a football tryout, 150-pound, at the Education Building on Baskin Hill.
Wow.
And we. 250 of us. Bill thinks there were 250 of us. He's probably
wow.
right. Appeared.
And this was in the fall of 1946?
Seven, rather.
I'm sorry.
And Diney was there, and he was the venerable baseball coach for decades at the University of Wisconsin. And he told us that we were going to use the single wing or short punt formation.
Yeah.
And he handed out play sheets, and we departed.
We had to fill out forms saying what position we wanted to play. And I think there were 28 people that said they wanted to be halfbacks.
Well, I don't think 28 out of the 250 is a high enough figure. I think probably down deep in their hearts, everybody wanted to play in the backfield, including our tackle, Ray Gleckler.
Did he say why this team, why did this team start? Why did they decide to start 150-pound?
Harry Stuhldreher came from Villanova. He was the head coach of the Badgers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably embellishing a little bit because this is part of what I'm going to say to the Quanah.
No.
And Harry came from Villanova, where he had previously been the head coach. Harry Stuhldreher was one of the four horsemen of Notre Dame from the late 1920s. And it was a fabulous backfield that was sold, that Grantland Rice named.
Mm-hmm.
Harry liked the sport so much that he wanted to introduce it for years before he was really able, he felt, to do it at the university. So he talked three other athletic directors, because that's what his role was here beside head football coach, into forming a four-man team, four-man league rather, and Ray did some research, and he found out most of what I'm saying now about Harry's and the other three ADs forming this conference within the major Big Nine. I say Big Nine because at the time Michigan State hadn't entered the Big Ten. And so then he was successful in doing that, but only in getting three other schools to do it. Michigan, Ohio State, and Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So we played a round robin schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to this information that we found, it seemed that Fritz Kreisler from Michigan, who was the football coach and probably athletic director as well, and Stuhldreher were the major forces in it. And Stuhldreher was not very big himself. He was quite a small man for a football player. Jack thinks he probably didn't weigh much more than 150 pounds. So he had a particular interest.
I think he had
compassion for the little man.
Yeah. Were you, the three of you, surprised at the number of people who came out for the tryout?
I had no preconceptions myself, but there were a lot of, as Bill said, it was a little lecture hall. Remember that, Bill? It was filled.
Well, I remember. Yeah. The lecture hall in the old Ed building.
Right as you come in and you
right
go to the right.
Right.
Yeah, their big lecture hall. Yeah.
And it was pretty much full.
Now, I remember you saying that you had played guard in high school.
Yes.
What about the two of you? Had you played in high school?
Well, I can speak for myself only. No, I weighed 117 pounds when I graduated from Madison East. And a pretty immature, mentally and physically, 117 pounds. Ray, I'll have to tell these guys something about these guys that they might not say. Ray was an all-state guard at Portage High School.
Hmm.
And Billy was an all-city halfback at Madison Edgewood. And that I think is quite a bit in their favor.
Did
yes?
No, go ahead.
Sorry, Barry.
No.
Proceed. Well, that's all I was going to say. I had no credentials.
So how did you, when did you, did Mansfield decide then who was going to be allowed to try out, or were all 228 invited, or how did that go?
Somehow he narrowed it down to about 50, and I don't, that's a kind of a vague point in my memory, how he narrowed it down from the 250, unless a lot of people were turned away even at the first meeting, because he was a pretty gruff, to-the-point man, and maybe he scared some people right at the very outset.
Well, I remember that he worked this out so hard that a lot of people quit.
Hmm. Yes, that's right.
I've run into people off and on over the years who said that they began the 150-pound football.
Yes, me too.
I think Bob Moyer from Moyer Art and Faith talked about it. He went out for a few days or something. Hmm. I think Bill's right. I think they discovered that this was more difficult than
in about 2 weeks, it was down to...
George Feith, the president of Capital Transamerica Insurance Company, often tells me about having played on the 150-pound team. He's in no picture.
It's one of these things where the team grows over time.
He probably weighed that at the time. Another potential candidate was Glenn Nording, later to become the basketball coach at Middleton High School for many years, and a boxer on the boxing team. And I have a hunch that Glenn Nording could not make the weight. And this could be a factor in terms of eliminating from 250 down. Some guys just couldn't make the weight. Mm-hmm. They thought they'd be able to, but the weight maximum was pretty stringent. And Bill and I and Ray don't quite agree on that. I remember that you couldn't weigh over 2 pounds more than 150 at the weigh-in of the first game, when officials with an official with a striped shirt was standing right by the scale. Remember that great big scale?
Oh yeah,
and he would direct people away, you know, if they didn't make it. And I'll have to just add in here that Don Dickinson, who was an NCAA boxing champion at 155 pounds at the time and was our fullback, couldn't make it for that Illinois game. He went to the boxing sweat box and sweated off enough poundage. Remember that at all?
I remember that.
I got a shot. So tell me about where did you practice?
Well, in those days, there were a lot of practice fields out on the engineering, you know, around Camp Randall Stadium. I think there's only one left. In fact, they're now considering building a parking ramp out. Mm. But in those days, there was quite a bit of open space. And I don't know, were there four practice fields, maybe more than that? I remember three distinctly.
Oh, yeah. The varsity practiced right near where we practiced.
Yeah,
not too far away.
Did you interact with the varsity at all?
Yes, we did, to the extent that we played in practice against any JV team member. Diney would, I remember, yet call that out. Any JV member, and they didn't, a lot of them were inactive quite a bit of the time. Any JV member under 190 pounds, come on over and scrimmage us. And we had a 135-pound guard named Jerry Darris, later to become a Monona physician. And Jerry Darris really had his hands full. And Diney did the right herd on him, too, for not making his blocks.
So, did you have games pretty soon in that first year? Was it a couple of weeks and you were on?
Yeah, I don't think we practiced too long before our first game. Not like the varsity, you know, they'd spring practice and the whole bit. But Diney, I think, taught the single wing, some people called it the short punt, purposely, so that it wouldn't be too complex a system for us to pick up in the short time that we had to do it.
Well, but he had, I know, he had three formations. He had T formation plays and short punt plays and single wing plays. And then he had defenses for a 5-, 6-, and 7-man line. And I know, I was a tackle. I didn't have to learn all the intricacies of these things, but I had to learn, I think, something like 53 different plays and defensive formations.
Wow.
Maybe more than that. I was really shocked because in high school, you know, it
six
wasn't
plays.
I don't remember using the T, Ray. Do you remember him ever running any plays off the T?
No.
He were always, the tailback always posted himself right behind the center.
Well, you guys would know.
The varsity at the time used the tee, but they always shifted out of it. Mm-hmm. The quarterback would get under the center, but they would always shift out.
Oh, that's really different. Yeah.
So then the tee actually became used, I think, a year or two later.
We used a short punt.
Yeah.
We didn't use the single wing.
Yeah. Well, but the single wing and the short punt are essentially the same, because we would always usually deploy the tailback right behind mm-hmm. the center, but not so far back that he was going to punt. So that's why they called it the short punt.
Yeah.
And then we also deployed the quarterback, the right halfback, and the fullback on any one or both sides. And if they were deployed strong this way, you'd usually run this way, and then it was called a single wing because mm-hmm. it was one wing going out that way. So I kind of think they were one and the same, Billy.
Now, were you playing, did you play halfback on the team? And you played?
Bill and I played the same position.
You mentioned the boxer. What was his name?
Don Dickinson.
Don Dickinson. Who are some of the other members of the team that you recall who were
Dwayne Dickinson interesting? Was Don Dickinson's younger brother, and they fought at practically the same weight, but I think Dwayne fought at 145 as opposed to Don's 155.
And Don was older. He was a veteran.
Yeah, Don was a very, very aggressive guy, and if you be in the
I'll
huddle,
bet.
And someone would mention to Don that if he'd made the block on that previous play, we would have had some big yardage, he would go across the huddle and grab the guy by the jersey. And I'm not kidding. I've seen it happen. I've been in the huddle when it happened. Dwayne, by contrast, who was also an outstanding boxer, was very docile. Mm.
Now, for people listening to this, they may not realize that UW had a wonderful boxing team. We were nationally ranked. We had one of the top teams consistently.
I think that throughout the years of boxing, Wisconsin could have been ranked the best overall team in the country collegiately.
Yeah.
We also had another boxer on our team who boxed at 135 pounds, and his name was Jimmy Schreenan, and he played mostly defensive back. I hope these guys are all bearing me out on this. If they don't, I'd like to hear them say that.
I went out for boxing, and I found that I either had to quit school or quit boxing.
Did you, Bill?
I had a headache every night.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Did you ever face Shreenan or any of those guys?
Oh, yeah. I boxed a lot of those guys.
You did? Wow.
Who was boxing coach? Just a little digression.
Johnny Walsh,
attorney in town for years,
long time coach.
I've got to mention Harold Hollis too. I think he was one of the leaders of the team.
Yeah,
he played center, and he was a real leader, I think.
Harold Hollis came from. He was a veteran too. He came from Alabama, and he had a deep Southern accent, which was quite in contrast with the rest of us. And usually, on a little 150-pound team, you aren't going to get guys in from Alabama. But I don't think he came. I don't think he came primarily to play football. Something brought him to Madison. Usually Truex Field would bring soldiers to Madison, and they'd like Madison so well they would never leave. They'd marry a local girl and stay here. And that may have happened with Harold Hollis. But Harold, as Bill says, was the catalyst around whom we all seemed to work. And he played center. He got knocked out a lot. I know that he got knocked out a lot. I couldn't believe it. He would come to, not for a long time, and he'd continue to play most of the time. But when he died in the middle 80s, I went to his wake, and they had a closed casket for him. But all along the top of the casket were artifacts and pictures from the 150-pound program.
Interesting.
And his wife told me that he just loved that 150-pound football that he had played.
Now, I'm still a little confused about the single wing. You had a quarterback?
Yes, but the quarterback called the signals but deployed himself.
So he was not the key player.
Harold Hulse, who was our center and a linebacker on defense, would snap the ball at an angle, at a quite steep angle, to one of the other backs. Most of the time it was straight back.
Straight back,
because he'd have to lead the tailback. Whichever way he was going to run, Hulse would lead you so that you'd sort of like catching a sort of pass. Short pass.
So the center really played a key role.
Center was very critical, as Bill said.
Who was the quarterback? Do you remember?
Tom Stellhammer. Played, we had depth, but Tom Tom Stahlhammer, I think, started both years.
He did, yeah.
He's a Milwaukee insurance man right now.
Now, you mentioned...
There
you go again. you mentioned the coach, Mansfield. Talk a little bit more about him. What was he like as a coach? Was he?
Well, I'm talking too much, I know him, but I just...
You started
just,
out, and they can jump in.
I just worked out a speech, so it includes a lot
Give
of
us
stuff.
Your speech on Mansfield.
Danny Mansfield came to Madison from Ohio, and he was a heavyweight boxer, and he had dynamite in both fists, so his nickname, of course, mm-hmm. was naturally Diney.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
his name was Arthur W. Diney Mansfield, and he really could pound. He was a big man in the sense that he had a very big torso and big neck and spindly little legs, about which he used to get teased by other coaches. Diney coached baseball, but his first love, everybody who knew anything about him said, was football. So when this program came along, he, I think, jumped at the chance. He probably asked Julia before Harry asked him. And Diney played baseball on local teams, too, when he was a younger man. And when he coached us, he was getting along in age, but he was very gruff. And he didn't like me very well at first at all. And I didn't like him either. And he didn't give me a chance. And then he gave me a chance, and I acquitted myself somewhat, and then I began to love the guy. And at our reunion after 30 years, he was quite ailing, but he did attend. And he was there with his wife, and we presented him. Bill went out and got a nice big clock. I think a mantle clock, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we gave it to him, and Jerry, he was sick. I think he was sick at the time. And Jerry Darris suggested that we hear from the coach, and I thought, I don't think this is going to work, and it didn't either. He stood up, he got almost straightened up, and he said in a real blubbering way, I can't talk. He just sat right there down. Remember
Boy.
That? And that was the end of the affair. But he was a very lovable guy once you got to know him.
Well, I always remember he had these big arms, and if you're coming back in the huddle and he didn't like something you did, he hit me behind the helmet.
Did you like him as a coach?
Oh, yeah.
You know why he liked him? Because he liked Billy.
Yeah, because he was starting key position. Was he generally well-liked by the team, do you think?
Oh, I think he liked him.
So. I think he was respected and maybe a little bit feared.
Good. That's not bad for a coach.
He was a very rough guy. When I was playing in high school, he used to referee some of the games. And I remember we played a very important game at Wisconsin Dells. And the score was close. And they had two huge linemen that weighed well over 200 pounds that the center and I had battled the whole game. And we were feeling pretty proud of ourselves because we were able to open up holes. Mm-hmm. Against these big guys. And so we came into the locker room after the game, which we won, and I walked up to the water fountain, the bubbler, and Mansfield was standing there holding the water open, you know.
Oh, the faucet, yeah.
And I thought, boy, this is really nice. There's a referee. He must have really thought I played a great game. Yeah. And I walked up and I took some water, and I said, thank you for holding this for me. And he said, I was just letting it get cold. That was my first contact with him. And he lived up to his image.
He stayed right there. One thing occurred to me as you were talking. What was it? You were wearing, obviously, the regular equipment. How does equipment then differ from today, 1990s?
Primarily, we had no face masks. Mm.
And those were those leather helmets?
And they were
those
leather helmets that fit. Malleable. They were protective. Yeah. There was nothing, you know, dangerous about those, I don't think, as opposed to the plastic ones.
Mm-hmm.
But the face mask, I think, was the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, we wore hand-me-down stuff from old varsity teams. I brought the picture up just to show Barry for the fun of it. I didn't.
Well, they used to, the pants were canvas pants. They were very rough. And at least in college, you're taught to block by, you took a shot at the guy and you pushed your face right up against him and then you slid your head off to the side to block. o'clock. In high school, we did it a little differently. But this meant that you were constantly hitting into somebody with your face. And then as you slid your head off to the side, you'd burn your cheeks or you'd burn your nose. And so that was supposed to be a sign of somebody who was blocking well, was that you had these burns or cuts or whatever on your cheeks and on your nose. And at our 50th reunion, Dickinson, Dwayne, who always had one on his nose, comes up to me and he says, hey, Gleck, I see you finally got rid of those scabs.
Ray did have a scab on his nose from the outset.
Yeah.
I remember that very distinctly.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell a little story about Diney again, and it involved me, of course. Diney wouldn't, I at this point in time was a three-letter man in track, and I had a beautiful red jacket with yellow sleeves, full leather, and a white W with three diagonals on it, and I wore that to the opening meeting thinking, well, this may work a little bit, but no way. Maybe it turned him off. It probably did. And so we had a full-scale scrimmage prior to the Illinois game. And we even had officials in striped shirts to make it more authentic. Jack Crabb, the big guy, if you remember him, he was one of the officials. He was in the Phi-Ed program, and Diney was a Phi-Ed instructor. So Billy, he'd played his stint, and he was long gone, and about three other guys in depth had played behind him, Ralph Haffey and a couple of others, I'm sure. And finally, as dusk started to settle over the practice field, Diney calls for a show of hands of anyone who hadn't been in yet. And I was within about half an inch of quitting because I couldn't take much more of that humiliation. So I raised my hand with three or four other scrubs, and he let us play. And I was so pent up that I did fairly well. And so maybe he was doing me a favor in the long run.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what? How many, it was a round robin, you played three games, or you played each team twice in the year, or how did that work?
We played Illinois twice, and then we played Michigan and Ohio State once.
So how'd you do on the first game?
We played Illinois and we won.
Here.
We won every game except when we played Michigan.
Yes.
But Michigan won way in, last time we played.
The Michigan game, and I have to qualify the fact that I watched it from the stands because I'd hurt my knee the previous game and I couldn't play. And so I think you and Ralph Haffey were the tailbacks for the most part for the whole game. And so I watched it at Bree Stevens, and Bree Stevens was full.
Oh, really?
Because the 150-pound team, I feel, were the darlings on the campus at the time. People really took to them, maybe because they were novel. I don't know. And it was in the mud, and they won quite handily, but they also won with the help of a halfback that they had, whose name was Jerry Burns. He played not only on their 150-pound team, but he played on their varsity team, and he later went on to coach the Minnesota Vikings.
Jerry Burns. Oh, interesting.
I was sitting at the Hall of Fame Club meeting one Tuesday noon, and a doctor who's retired in Madison, whose name is Bill Bartlett, and he played second string quarterback at Michigan at about that same time. And he gave me that little sidelight on Jerry Burns.
Yeah, I think I interviewed Bill at one point several years ago. Yeah,
he'd be a good interview, I'll bet.
Did, at the games, did you have bands and cheerleaders? Was it just?
We had the band. Appeared at one game. It was one of our home games, obviously. I read it in one of those clippings. That's the only one. In fact, it may have been the second year.
Well, a friend of mine from Portage was a member of the band, and I remember his telling me that they were going to play and had playing and so forth.
So we didn't. We played Illinois in our first game. We did not have cheerleaders per se, and not a band except for that one game. But at that time, we didn't have a second deck. But from the goal line to the goal line, on the west side, the stands were full.
Hmm.
So however many people that is, that's what we drew for our first game.
That's and you there was publicity, I assume, in the,
oh, we were
the
getting
campus
gritty.
Papers. And you mentioned before the interview a sports writer who's a, more or less a legend here in Madison, Roundy. Talk about Roundy for a moment.
Well, Roundy was a legendary character, and I got a little anecdote about him that I'm going to tell at my Kiwanis Club speech, but it takes a couple of minutes, so I think I'll just skip it.
You
right
can,
now.
You, we have, please tell
well,
it.
I don't. Have you heard my Roundy stink about when so. I caddied for him? Well, I caddied at Maple Bluff. What I'm going to do is, in my talk at the Kiwanis Club, say that when I graduated high school in 1940, I couldn't afford to go on to school. My parents didn't have the money, nor did I. But that I was trying to save money by caddying in the summertime. Caddying paid between 65 and 85 cents for 18 holes, depending on whether or not you got a tip. Now, caddies at Maple Bluff get $25 a round.
Do they really?
$25 a round.
I'm in the wrong business.
And one day, somewhere between 36 and 40, I had Roundy as my player. And he was playing the 17th hole along with three other influential Madison businessmen. Roundy was a complete freeloader. And they were playing the 17th hole, and the caddies four-caddied on that hole because there was the woods on the right. So I was deployed down there with the other three caddies, and Roundy hit one down against and between some tree roots next to a great big tree. And he always wore houndstooth pants and black and white shoes and a gaudy shirt. And I don't think that what do you call that stretchable material that was so popular for a short while?
Polyester.
I don't think polyester had come in yet, but if it was in, he was wearing it.
Whatever came right before polyester, maybe.
He came down, and as he approached me, the other players were on the left side of the fairway, and this is on the right, and as he approached me, he says, "How does it look, Addy, huh?" And this is quite a bit of me.
Yeah, he always said, "Huh."
Yeah. And I said, "Sir, it doesn't look so good." Well, what do you mean, Caddy? And I says, "It's down here between the tree roots." And he says, "Well, kick it out." I said, "Sir, I can't do that." "Well, I will." So he kicked it out. Kicked it out a little bit into the fairway toward it. And he's scrubbed the ball on up to the green. He wasn't a bad player, but he wasn't very good either. And they all putted out. And John St. John, who at the time was the chairman of the board of the Madison Gas and Electric team, our company, and who got Maple Bluff through the Depression almost single-handedly by dint of his force and his intelligence, and looked just like Al Capone, right down to the cigar.
Probably helped.
John St. John always kept score, and he always handed his caddy his cigar, which was always juicy, when he was going to either shoot or put the scores down. And he was the only member out there who was able to have his own permanent caddy for the 4 years as a kid caddy through high school. Everybody else had to take what came. Mm-hmm. And the other two members of the foursome besides St. John were Oscar Rennebaum, prior to his being the governor, mm-hmm. and Milton Findorf of the Findorf Construction. Yeah. And so when he called out, and he always called Roundy Joe, as they all did. All his close friends called him Joe. His name was Joseph Roundy Coffin. And he said, "What'd you have, Joe?" And he said, "I had a five, huh?" One of the other members said, "I don't think so. I think we saw you kicking the ball out in the roof." And he said, "Well, ask my caddy."
Oh, no.
And so I said, "Well, he did kick the ball." I didn't say what he had, but I said he did kick the ball out from behind the roots there. And Roundy turned to me and he said something I've never heard called, I've never been called that before or since, and he said, "You fart blossom, huh?" So they put down a 6-4 in my career. And we walked down the 18th fairway, and Roundy didn't say a word to me. And I was paid at the end of the round by one of the other members, because mm-hmm. Roundy was an absolute freeloader. Mm-hmm. But he paid him back in his own way, because the next day in the paper, he always had in the sports section about a one full column, sometimes a carryover to two or one and a half, a column of his own. Mm-hmm. It was always headed Roundy SEZ period. Mm-hmm. Roundy says.
Roundy says.
Whenever whenever there'd be the name of any important individual that he had consorted with, it would always be in bold type. Mm-hmm. So, of course, he had played golf, and he never wrote the column himself. A lady named Mrs. Edith Goodman did. He'd submit her scraps, and she'd compile it in his own style.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, that was a fact
that
a lot of people
didn't
know.
That. No, I didn't know.
Well,
that.
He had this little paragraph starting out, played golf at Maple Bluff yesterday with, and of course, bold type, all their names are in bold type, had a caddy from Madison East High School. Kid couldn't even count. That was it. I hope the Kiwanians think it's funny.
Have you saved that, Jack? That newspaper item?
No, I never. I could probably.
You could find it.
Archives.
Oh, it's
yeah.
They
weren't microfilming then, I'm sure.
The Wisconsin State Historical Society, which has one of the great newspaper collections in the United States, will have that. If you
could
narrow it down
to about 1938 or 9.
Yeah, if you can get it narrowed down, you can probably find it pretty easily.
That'd be a great thing to have.
Yeah, I'd blow that up and take it to the Kiwanis. I am going to take the plaque. I'm going to take my plaque, and I'm going to take that team picture and let them pass that around to occupy their time while I talk.
Now, Rowdy, when he wrote his column, it was sort of sentence fragments and things like that.
Yeah,
it was always just,
I
remember a long time ago seeing some of his stuff, and it's just...
For a while, they always headed up his column with him pushing a lawnmower, because his nickname was also the old lawnmower pusher. He mowed the playground in the park at Brittingham.
Just for...
Well, for pay.
For pay, oh, for pay.
Sorry about that, boys.
Okay, you won your first game. What about the rest of the first year? Who did you play? How did you do? Any anecdotes that you particularly remember from the team?
Bill remembers maybe the sequence of games. I don't.
Well, we played Illinois first, and then we played Ohio State.
Away,
yeah. We went to Ohio State and played them. And then we played Michigan, and then we played Illinois again.
Okay, here are the scores. October 18th, Wisconsin 26, Illinois 6. October 31st, Wisconsin 13, Ohio State nothing. November 15th, Michigan 13, Wisconsin nothing. And November 22nd, Illinois 20, Wisconsin 20, Illinois 12.
There are varying views on what the scores of those games were, and I think that Ohio State had a touchdown. It wasn't 12 to nothing.
13 to nothing. 13.
They had a touchdown because they were leading at halftime.
And it says here that Bill McCormick was the second leading scorer for 1947.
Second. Who was first?
12.
Southhammer.
That was your.
I think Ohio State did have a touchdown.
I think they did too.
Yeah.
Because we were behind at halftime.
I think it was 13.
And I have a little anecdote about that.
Shoot.
Is it okay?
I don't want to try to talk more than I should be here.
But I'm sort of rehearsing for my.
Do your rehearsal. This is a dress rehearsal.
We went over to Ohio State on a Pullman car, which is pretty fancy for that time. And I was, for some reason, assigned to the same berth as Coach Mansfield. And as I've said before, he was a big man. And so I suggested that I clamber up the stairs to the second berth. And he gruffly said to me, "You're playing tomorrow, I'm not." And so he made his way up to the top berth, and I could hear him tossing and turning up there till I fell asleep myself. The next day at the game, we were behind at halftime, and he gave us a pep talk in the dressing room during the half. Mm-hmm. And he was so emotional, and I think he was just an emotional man that I really didn't realize that much, except for that occasion when he broke down at the end of his pep talk and couldn't finish it.
Wow.
And when he couldn't talk at the reunion 30 years later. That might have been largely due to his just emotion, an emotional man. And he couldn't, and then we all agreed that we could have run through the wall to get back to the practice, to the playing field if we had to. And then we ended up winning the game by scoring 2 touchdowns.
Anything else memorable about that first year? Any of the games or?
There are a lot of memorable things. The practices were tedious, and playing against those bigger guys was not much fun. But it made it easier when you played against someone that weighed 150.
Yeah, I bet.
I remember waking up one morning before the game, and I couldn't turn my head. And I got in the game, and the first hit, then I was fine. I could turn my head.
No kidding. Yeah. I got to go down the hall again, you guys.
Okay, we'll take a
right in the face with this guy's helmet, because I didn't get down low enough. And I was sort of woozy, my mud, you know, and I was trying to clean the mud out of my eyes and try to get my head cleared. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked around, and everybody around me was blue. And I was in the Michigan huddle. it was right at the quarter, and they had changed positions on the field. And it was really embarrassing. So I had to walk about 10 yards back to the Wisconsin line of scrimmage.
Now, Michigan was the champion both years?
No, we were co-champions.
You were co-champions. Oh, so they lost to someone else. Yeah, you just
lost,
happened to lose.
We don't know who.
Yeah. They lost to Ohio State.
They did? Yeah. Both times, Billy?
Both times.
Oh.
And when they had to weigh in, they lost six players.
Oh, yeah.
That's why they wouldn't weigh in when they played us. But Ohio State beat them both years.
Now, when we were off mic for a second, Bill, you made an interesting comment about the refs at Michigan and at Ann Arbor when you played Michigan.
Well, I remember some plays, and in my opinion, they were pro-Michigan.
Yeah.
But, that's just my opinion.
Would make sense to me.
Well, one other thing about Diney, he taught football at the university. He was in the school of physical education department, and that was one of his classes, and he used to teach in the old Ed building up on, it was either third or fourth floor. There was a lecture hall up there, and he had this booming voice, and you could hear him all the whole floor, and the art department was also there.
Interesting.
And we could hear it. I was teaching a class, and sometimes you wonder whether it was in football or art. Because you'd hear Diney down the hall.
Yeah, that's the way it went.
Did you get trophies that first year for being co-champions? Or the department, the athletic department?
I think it was somewhat informal.
Informal.
It was still an intercollegiate sport.
Yeah.
And Ray...
Yeah, now this was sanctioned by the Big Ten and everything.
When we appealed to get on the field to play during the half, which we did, and we tried for W's even, major W's and rings and plaques.
Now, major W, for those who don't understand, that's what you get for what they considered the major sports?
That's right. That's what you get.
Basketball and football. Yeah.
And we got shot down by Pat Richter. And Bill knows, we all know Pat Richter, and I know him fairly well. And so I was talking to Pat a lot. He says, no, Jack, we can't sanction that because it was a club sport. So we would have meetings occasionally and at lunch, and Ray heard that, and he really delved in and found out and sent me some stuff, red underlined, where it was an intercollegiate Western Conference sport.
Yeah, and you used up, if you played 150-pound football and then were to play on the varsity, the 150-pound football counted as a year of eligibility.
No, it did.
It did.
Oh, well, that would... That would fix that.
In the minutes, they had a couple appeals to the Big Ten commissioners regarding this, where one was a Michigan player who had played a year 150-pound and then was playing on the varsity.
This could have been Jerry Burns.
Jerry Burns, yeah.
Of course, if he played concurrently,
yeah.
You know, both in the same year, he's using up the year anyway.
That was the case. It was a year of eligibility. Also, in those days, they had minor sports, major sports and minor sports, which you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall offhand what the minor sports were, but...
I don't think there were so much minor sports, but they were minor letters. You could win minor letters in a... All the sports were pretty much on a par in terms of getting a major W, even gymnastic and fencing, which I don't think they have now anymore.
No, those are both.
But you'd get a minor letter if you didn't have enough quarters or whatever it took to get a major letter. But Pat Richter, the week prior to the Illinois game this year, called me and said, Jack, and he acted like, I'm not relenting. He acted like it was his idea.
Ah.
He said, Jack, I want you guys down the field at halftime. And he says, I want you to get W rings if you want to. See, the W ring is a ring with a red, it's a red stone with a nice gold W in it. And it's been exclusive to letter winners until now. So we're going to buy these at our own cost.
Darn right.
about $224 a ring. From Goodman's, through Goodman's, and it has to be an official sanctioned situation because they don't give them out to just anybody, they say. So I've got to give, after Ray compiles it, a list of the names to the Goodman people, and we're going to get them.
Okay. Ray was rummaging around for something.
No, I'm just, I just wanted to check and see if that was Burns.
No, I don't think it was his name. I read through that later too, Ray. No, I don't think it was.
When the second year started, did you had pretty much the same people back, the same coach and everything like that?
I was a senior at the end of the first year, so anything about the
left.
Second year, these guys have to tell you about.
How did the second year go?
It was very similar to the first year. And, as a matter of fact, we came out the same in the second year. We won all the games except Michigan.
There's something about Michigan. Did you, was the fan support the same as the first year?
Pretty much,
pretty
I think.
Popular, yeah. What happened then? Why did the team get axed after 2 years?
Economic thing. It cost too much to have two football teams.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why they discontinued it.
Well, go ahead, Ray.
According to these minutes, at the meeting, I can't locate this, but Purdue and Indiana and one other school were going to start 150-pound football, but they said they would want to wait at least another year. And Minnesota said they were not going to start it. So, and they had problems because of the cost and everything. So apparently Chrysler and Stuhldreher wanted to continue it, but without the other schools taking it up, they decided to drop it.
Were there any other conferences, Ray, that you know of, or any other schools around the country that had programs like this?
Well, in the East, go ahead, Joe.
In the East, it was very prevalent. As I said earlier, that's how Harry Stuhldreher first found out about, or was aware of
that's right. That's
right. Football. And now, in retrospect, I think that I remember distinctly that Ohio State had many players on their team who had played 150-pound football in high school. So evidently it had worked its way far enough west to have included Ohio. And I wouldn't be surprised if Michigan didn't have it, too. Because Michigan had such a mature, well-schooled team, I thought.
So they had almost like a farm system.
Right. They were playing it in high school, and then they just continued on into
college.
They
still have 150-pound football out east, don't they?
Well, sure. But now it's 165 pounds.
Ah,
yeah,
interesting.
They raised
raise the bar, hey? That's very interesting.
Not 5 pounds, but 15.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people are bigger now.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. When did you hear that it had been disbanded? Was it after the year?
I think so. I don't recall exactly.
Did you have eligibility left, either of you, after the second year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was in ROTC at the university, and we had spent the summer in Virginia at summer camp. I can't remember whether I found out about it when we came back or whether someone wrote to me while I was there. So it must have been in the summer of 49 that we first heard about it, or that I first heard about it. Because I was all set to come back and play football.
Mm.
Did you ultimately go into the service then with the commission?
No. Oh. I developed an ulcer in my senior year. I didn't have that opportunity for release playing football, so I had all that stress.
I was in the Navy ROTC.
Oh, you were? Did you go on into? Well, you went into the Navy actively, didn't you?
After graduation,
Well, I after being 2 years out of high school and quite broke yet from working at the, as a result of working at the Madison Kip, where I didn't get paid very much, did get a draft notice. I'm older than these guys. In 1942, and I immediately enlisted in the Air Corps. And I got in, became a pilot, and the war ended thanks to Harry Truman. And then I came back and started my freshman year of college, the university. Whereas, Bill, were you a freshman in 47 or a sophomore?
Freshman.
Oh.
Well, I graduated from high school in 46, so I suppose.
Well, then you were a sophomore.
I was a sophomore then, because I would have started right after.
So that's our draft, our service status.
That's interesting. Did anyone, I keep thinking of you guys with the mud on your face. Did anyone ever get broken noses or anything?
I was going to say that and forgot. At the time Ray talked about plastic helmets, we played our second game against Illinois down at Illinois at Champaign the first year. And we usually would play in practice fields adjacent to the stadium. When we played Ohio State, we were going to play in the stadium, that major bowl stadium that they have, but it was a wet day. And they were going to play Indiana the next day, and they didn't want us to
wreck the field.
But against Illinois, I remember my nose coming right to a plastic helmet and it breaking. And toward the end of the first half, and then during the second half, we had a big, rotund team physician from Portage, Ray's hometown, whose name was Dr. Rickard. Dr. Rickard. And he came up, and he manipulated my nose around a little bit and said, "Yes, you broke it." No, I played in the second half. Listen, we were pretty gung ho.
I'll bet.
Also, in the Ohio State game, Joe Peterson, and I forgot to mention this, Joe and Paul Peterson were wrestlers. Many of us played in other sports, and some of us did. And the two Peterson brothers were wrestlers. Joe Peterson, who played end, had one of his teeth shoved up through his lip. And he came to the bench, I'll never forget that either, and Rickard, I believe, just carefully lifted his lip off around his tooth and did some stitching either there or in the dressing room, but it was right then. And I'm not sure, but I think Joe even played. Maybe not. Maybe I'm stretching it.
Well, you can stretch it a little bit. What the heck?
Well, in those days, for blocking, you had to keep your hands against your jersey.
Now you can grab on and all that.
No, you can't.
Well, you can
do everything
sort of.
But sort of.
If you're clever, you can grab on.
And so, it wasn't unusual for a lineman to have what they call throw a forearm. In other words, you could bring your elbow this way, which did a lot of noses in, because if you ever caught someone on the side with your elbow, it could break their nose pretty fast. So it wasn't, broken noses really weren't that unusual. And then, of course,
no, they weren't.
Straight on, there were no face guards. So.
I think they were called forearm shivers.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
I got one of those in high school. I was an offensive tackle, and I stood straight up once, and this guy got me, and I couldn't talk for about a day
after. Where did you go to high school?
At Riverside High School in Milwaukee.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Lousy team, but it'd be a lot of
fun. Well, Ray had that scab just the whole year. I think he had primarily one in his nose and once in a while here and there. But I'll tell you, it was a badge of honor. I respected these guys that had that scab.
It's like at Heidelberg, where if you have the scar on your face, means that you were on the dueling team. And
had bony elbows, so I always had scabs in my elbows, but not in my face where people could usually see it.
I see on this card that Harold House was the captain for both years. And Al Manchesky was the assistant coach. Do you remember anything about him?
I know
the first
Al Manchesky
year?
Very well today, because Al was on the track team when I was. And Al was a pole vaulter, and he came from Green Bay, and he was a Phi Ed major. Phi Ed majors, I wouldn't say they were favored by Diney, but he was very well aware of their presence out there. Like Don Dickinson, Don Dickinson didn't get reprimanded too often by Diney. Not as often as most of the rest of us. But Al Manchesky then went into coaching and was a successful coach up in the Green Bay area, and also coached our 150-pound team as an assistant coach, and played on the varsity football team for a year or two, and who weighed about 150 himself. Mm-hmm. He wasn't, you know, remember Al, he was not very big at all.
No, he wasn't.
Well, George Bauer was also an assistant.
The second year, George Bauer and Dick Howden, H-O-U-D-Howden, were both.
Dick Howden was also on the track team, and at one time, Dick held the indoor part. I remember what he was on the track team, but I said he was, and he was a assistant coach in the football team, and he was on the football team one year, the varsity football team, but his greatest claim to fame was that he tied the indoor record for the 60-yard dash, which he achieved in the field house. Now, that may be hard for you to believe, but we ran track meets in the field house.
Oh, yeah.
Indoor track meets around the posts. There were times when you could be at one side of the track running and didn't know who was on, you know, who was anywhere except right behind or ahead of you.
Well, didn't you used to, a long time before your time, didn't they hold championships and meets in the red gym? Yeah, there was a track indoor that you could still kind of see.
I don't know that. No, they didn't have meets in there.
Did they?
Oh,
okay.
No, I saw a meet there. I saw Lloyd LeBeach run.
No. What you saw was a track meet held in the Armory Annex.
Yeah.
In the Annex to the Red
annex.
Gym. Not in the
not
Red
in,
Gym.
In the Red Gym, there is a track above. That's practice or was?
That's an exercise track.
That
but,
was.
But we had a little, we had an, well, they called it the Armory Annex. And it was a little building annexed to the Red Gym.
Yeah.
Part of it, just walked through a doorway into it. And it was real dark always, and it had a dirt track. And I wish I could remember the distance around it, because I ran a lot of races on it. And they could only run the 40-yard dash between the curves of the track, because it just wasn't that big a track. Usually you could run a lot further. And the 40-yard hurdles. And when somebody ran any one of those races, they'd have to run, after finishing the race, through the pole vault pit, which at the time was sawdust, up across the bank of the track, up across the shot put area, and against a padded wall out near the boathouse, you know, where the University boathouse was at the time. Anybody running that distance would have to do all that.
I bet you can still smell that dirt if you really put your mind to it down. I remember that in high school in Milwaukee, we'd have these indoor track meets in the most unlikely places you can imagine.
Well, that's where we did run our meets, right?
What happened to that annex?
Well, the annex was removed.
It was removed
that,
in
that building. That's the, isn't it the alumni building?
Yeah, the alumni building was put up there. Yeah. I think that was removed after the field house. No.
Well, we used that at the field house. The use of the field house preceded using the annex.
Right.
Didn't they start a fire or something in the annex during the protest years?
He could have.
Well, they started fires in the Red Gym.
Yeah.
They meant to bomb the ROTC, but they got the offices mixed up and they bombed the coaches' offices.
No kidding.
They went to, I mean, it isn't that hard. There are only two sides of the building, but the protesters went to the wrong side and they threw some Molotov cocktails through the window and they destroyed the coaches' quarters. As a matter of fact, up until the repairs, you could go back there and you'd go into some of these burned out. It was like walking into a history book, because they would still, remember those old lap counters they used to have where the person would stand and flip the lap? Well, they were sitting there, right, you know, all charred and scarred. It was just sort of like they had been used the day before. And
I think they used those primarily for swimming, because the swimming pool was in.
Or maybe it was for a swimming pool,
Gym.
But they bombed the coaches' quarters, and the ROTC quarters were fine. They left those, they missed it. Now, Ray, you were going to say something about George Bauer.
Oh, well, George was also an assistant. He was the gymnastics coach as well, and he taught physical education for years and years.
George comes to the reunions.
Well, the team's gone now. It's the year's the second year's over. The team is disbanded. How did you guys start getting back to? How did it work afterwards that you started your reunions?
Well, we had a 30-year reunion at the Cuba Club. And I guess people
Cuba
would
Club.
Come to me. Tim Dennis somehow thought that I would be able to start one or something. But he was really the driving force. Ken Dennis, the gentleman who gave us the $1,000.
Oh, yeah.
He lives up in Butamore now, which is adjacent to Oshkosh. And he would call me on the phone and say, Jack, this is Ken Denny. He always called himself Ken Denny, still does for some reason. I think we ought to have a reunion. So the guys that were in town, at the time it was Bill and I, and I don't know, Ray was here, but we just, were you on our committee? I don't think you're on the committee,
no,
though.
No,
for some reason.
The first one.
I don't know why, nothing personal. And it was Bill and Jerry Darris, the physician I told you
mm-hmm.
about, who weighed 135 mm-hmm. pounds, and I. And we got up the first reunion at the Cuba Club, which is held at the Cuba Club, that Diney attended. And it was very successful, I thought. Didn't you, Bill? It was just well attended, and of course the wives
oh,
all
yeah.
came along.
It was a nice reunion. I think Jack was pretty much the organizer of the reunion.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that, Bill.
I went to the meetings with him. Listen to him.
But Ken Dennis really did something neat at the reunion. He had an old raggedy t-shirt that said Property of the University of Wisconsin. And he had it in a paper bag. I saw that paper bag. I couldn't figure out what he had next to him in that paper bag next to his chair because I had a good shot at it. And he opened up the paper bag at the proper time and walked up to Coach Mansfield, and he, through guilt, said that he was finally going to turn in his t-shirt. Remember that? Then we had one. Then again, and it, when it was, I figured this is about, you know, this is it, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
what the heck. Well, then, I think 3 or 4 years ago, Ken Dennis called me up again. Jack, Ken Denny, I think we ought to have another reunion. So we got another one up, and we met at Union South.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah,
and as we did this past Illinois game,
mm-hmm.
I know the secretary of the W Club pretty well, Terry Morawski.
Mm-hmm.
So through Terry, I got tickets for whoever would mail back and say that they wanted to see the football game. And that happened 3 or 4 years ago. I've forgotten what year exactly. And that was well attended. We
yeah,
had maybe one or two less players than we had this time. But I think the lure this time was Ron Dane and the fact that he was going to play. So we ended up having 19 of our players down on the field. Now, some of them have season tickets like I and Bill do, but others bought tickets and went to the game. So the game, the plaques, I wish I had a plaque with me. I think they look pretty good. But, of course, I'm prejudiced because I worked them up. And we got to see the game, the plaque, the reunion, getting on the field.
Well, I was attending that game, and I had no idea what was going to happen at halftime. And all of a sudden, I heard this announced, and immediately I flashed in on the interview that we did with Ray a couple of years ago. So I just stood there and waited as they introduced it. And you probably didn't hear me, but I applauded when my wife and I stood up and gave you a round of applause for your participation. No, I think that's one of the things that really makes university life great are these organizations and clubs. Faculties have them in dining clubs, and students have them in these different organizations. And just the fact that you've gotten together at the 30-year and the 50-year reunion, and I'm sure kept contact among yourselves in informal ways.
Well, Bill McCormick of the McCormick Lumber and Fuel at the time company, and his two brothers, one of his brothers, Pat,
yeah.
and several other players had a strong volleyball team.
Hmm.
And we thought we had a strong volleyball team,
hmm.
one that I played on. So through the years, I played a lot of volleyball against Bill after getting
hmm.
out of school. And Ray, I see through curling, and we have
oh,
a common
curling.
Interest in art.
Yeah.
And Ray and I are both longtime curlers. Bill curled with me 1 or 2 years.
Yeah.
And we have built a brand new curling club now.
Oh,
really?
McFarland. No, he wasn't. And it's just a state-of-the-art curling club. I could go on for another half
That's
hour
great.
On that.
Well, one thing about those T-shirts, Dennis's T-shirt, you used to wear those, Property UW Athletics, proudly on campus
mm-hmm.
because that distinguished you as an athlete. It had another advantage in that every day, of course, you got all clean gear, socks and
mm-hmm.
shorts and supporters and this kind of. So the university would, in a sense, be doing your laundry. And you could do that with the T-shirts and also with the towels. So you always had a University of Wisconsin towel, and you always had a University of Wisconsin T-shirt, and they were always clean.
And socks.
happens.
What about a training table? Did you guys have access to a training table?
Not really. We had Walter Bakke, the longtime trainer, help out a little bit, but not too much. No, he didn't seem to. I never had my ankles taped. Did you ever have your ankles taped?
Oh, yeah, they used to.
I didn't.
I never did, no.
No, they had people that taped, that's right. There were managers, probably Fayette majors or whatever.
Dick Miyagawa, who was another NCAA champion boxer, worked in the training room, and he taped our ankles and wrists. At least the linemen. That's because you guys did that.
Well, yeah, right. The linemen deserve all that kind
of
stuff.
I remember once hitting a guy with a, with a forearm shiver, whatever you call it.
Shiver.
There we go.
Like this. And the tape snapped. And it just split all the way up my wrist. Oh, and I thought, Miyagawa did a good job.
Well, if you're a halfback, you might be sure you get a little with the lineman.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll quit blocking.
Yeah. Don't you guys buy them Rolex watches or something like that after every season?
I remember, I do, and this is not kidding, running up Ray's back or right behind Ray in a lot of plays.
Yeah,
I kid him. A few years ago, we were curling together, and I was curling lead, and Jack was skipping the rink and calling all the sweeping. And so I'm sweeping this stone all the way down the ice, and I'm getting a little old for that kind of thing. And I look up, and there's Jack standing in the house. And I said, oh, you halfbacks. You're always the glory boys.
And did I love any fan.
Once a halfback, always a halfback.
Well, when I swept, when I curled for Jack,
Bill was our lead.
I just knocked myself out. I had black and blue marks all over my arms. He worked me so hard.
Oh, yeah.
For anyone who's listening who's never seen a curling match, I'm not even going to begin to describe them. They're the most peculiar looking things you'll ever see.
Oh, yeah. But once you're a curler, it's a cult. It's a cult sport.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we're just ending the tape. I think this is a good place to get. Anybody have anything else, or are we all set? Okay, we'll call it a wrap, as they say.